You're listening to the Australian Organic Collective, Episode 3, with your host, Kelsey Taylor. Welcome back for another episode. In this one, I catch up with Owen Gwilliam. Owen has worked in organic certification for almost 20 years. He brings a wealth of accumulated knowledge to events, industry groups, interviews, and publications. Owen has conducted organic auditing, consulting, and training in 15 countries, predominantly throughout the Asia Pacific region. He currently sits on the National Standards Subcommittee and serves Australian Organic Limited in the role of Chief Technical Officer. He's our technical guy. What that really means, though, we'll get into that later on in this episode. This podcast is sponsored by Cleavers Organic. Feeding the family or you're feeding the team? You can trust Cleavers for 100% delicious certified organic meat. Plus, every Cleavers product is carbon neutral. Find yours in the fresh meat section at your supermarket. The Australian Organic Collective podcast shares stories from its members and the wider organic industry. Join us as we learn more about the farmers, manufacturers, and brands behind some of your favourite certified organic products. If you'd like to be involved with a future episode, please get in touch with us via any one of our social media platforms or via email, contact@austorganic.com. Welcome to the Australian Organic Collective podcast, Owen. It's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me. It's finally happening. I'm very excited.
Now, before we get too carried away, let's start off with, in your words, what is certified organic and what does it actually mean?
Great question. Well, I studied agriculture and have learned a bit about farming and how it relates to the environment, especially over the years. And organic farming is the best framework or set of rules that I've found to help farmers make better decisions about farming with regard to environmental aspects and the health of the food that's produced in the end, and also animal welfare and a whole range of topics. So I consider organic farming to be best practice farming, and certified organic farming means that a trusted third party of some sort has been there and checked out the farm or checked out the processing facility to ensure that it does comply with the organic rules, so you can actually trust that it is actually organic.
You've been in the organic industry for about half of your life now.
Makes me feel old.
In various positions and even in many countries as well. I know that you've travelled quite a bit for various roles within the industry. But let's go back to the very beginning. You actually studied at university. Why did you decide to go down the path of organic and learning more about the organic space?
Yeah, so I studied agriculture, science in agriculture at Sydney Uni, and majored in soils and saw a lot of different farming systems through that period, and really came out of the end of that degree not wanting to work in conventional farming. Many of my peers ended up working as sort of sales agronomists, so selling chemicals essentially. It was something I definitely didn't want to do. So I was fortunate enough to have been exposed to organics already, as my father was working in the industry in the early days in Australia. So I kind of jumped in the deep end and started doing inspections for what was then BFA, and really learnt a lot in those first few years of visiting different organic farms.
So it's probably pretty safe to say that back then, when you had just finished uni, it was kind of almost the start of the organic industry, and it wasn't.
I'm not quite that old, Kelsey.
But there really wasn't too much knowledge out there about what organic was. So over the years, have you found that people are a lot more receptive and people are a lot more eager to find out about how they can transition to a certified organic or organic practices?
Yeah, no, but you're right. It was still early days. And in a way, it is still early days, I guess. It's
definitely.
All relative. But I do remember the national standard at that point was a little half A4 page size booklet. I think it was in version one still, or one point something, when I was at uni and when I was talking about this with some of my peers. So it was very alternative then, yeah. And now it's really
becoming a great word to use, is alternative.
It was very alternative. It was very small. I don't know what the dollar figures were. I mean, nobody really knows. It was that small. It was, you know, sort of only tens of millions probably in value at that point in terms of organic produce. But a lot of work was done in the 80s in Australia in the development of the national standard and finding a place in the regulatory environment for that standard to live. Since since then, I didn't know that I would work in the organic sector, organic industry necessarily for as long as I have, but there wasn't really a career path. It was really small. I probably was one of the first full-time organic inspectors in the country for a while. And I was very much in the deep end at that point. These days, there is a career path, and the growth of the industry throughout that time has just been phenomenal. It's not uncommon to have double-digit percentage growth year on year in terms of sales, which then, you know, is based on more farmers and more manufacturers and more product lines. And for a while, I guess I took it for granted that I was working inside of an incredibly fast-growing industry and sort of not realizing it. But yeah, it's been a really exciting 20 years, and it's still growing at the moment. It's still double-digit percentage growth rates year on year. Not many industries enjoy that.
Mm. And I think, like you said, it is still very early days, especially for such a young industry.
Yeah, so organic certification is a whole supply chain certification. So it needs the operations need to be certified at the farm level and then at processing and wholesaling, manufacturing. There's even certification available for retailers and exporters. It means as an inspector or as an auditor, as they call us, you have the opportunity to visit lots of different types of facilities and understand the whole supply chain. So I've been to hundreds, probably more than 1,000 farms. I really definitely have lost count over the years in Australia and also throughout Asia Pacific region, or Southeast Asia especially, and the Pacific. So those inspections can be very varied. Sometimes it's a trader, so it's just an office situation, or it might be a complex processing facility, or the other sort of end of the spectrum might be extensive rangeland cattle production out west, or in Asia or the Pacific, the growers group program, where there are some hundreds of farmers under the one certification with small land holdings and just with their patch of coconuts or coffee plantation or whatever it is. So yeah, it's been hugely interesting and a learning experience.
So with that, as one of those producers on an island, say coconuts, what is it that you do when you get there?
Firstly, just surviving the journey to get there is important, including the light aircraft and the boat trips and so on. But the audit process is basically the same as here in Australia. We look at the documented procedures for how they manage the farm, and that includes how they manage fertility and pest and disease management and how protection from contamination and animal welfare, all sorts of stuff, depending on the type of operation. And all of those documented plans are approved up front by the certification body. And that's what's called the organic management plan. That's what individual operators' certifications are based on. They're approved organic management plans. And the job of the auditor is just to double check that the organic management plan actually matches reality. So they're really doing what they're saying in their approved organic management plan. So in that way, it's quite similar to a quality assurance certification or a food safety certification, in that this is our documented plan for how we're going to comply to the standard. ACO or whatever other certifier checks off on that, signs off on that, and then the inspector or auditor just checks that that's what's really happening on the ground. And that's why we'll do it either on an annual basis, or also unannounced inspections are an important part of that checking as well.
So what's the likelihood of somebody fabricating the organic management plan and doing something incorrect, or day-to-day doing something wrong, and then you guys come in and just make sure that things are okay on that one day?
It's pretty hard to know the answer to that. So what you're asking about is fraud, basically. Mm, someone saying, definitely. Yeah, this is what we do on the organic management plan, and then they're actually using some herbicide or something that's not allowed.
Is there testing?
Yes. So one of the ways we will pick up on that will be through soil testing for residues or produce testing for residues, and that's done by the certifiers on a percentage of produce all year round. There's also additional targeted audits based on tip-offs. In reality, tip-offs happen, and they're probably the most common thing that leads to an investigation that leads to someone being suspended or decertified. There are telltale signs that you can look out for as an inspector, especially with something like herbicide, but also with other... So you're checking input storage, you know, including opening containers in sheds and all that. The certified operator has to agree to make all access to all areas available to the inspector. But you can also get a bit of a clue for if they do actually have sufficient proactive management procedures in place to, for instance, manage the weeds. Like if they're not giving a reasonable explanation of how they manage weeds, then you might pay extra attention to whether they might be using herbicide or something.
Mm. In order to be classified as certified organic for a farmer, what is it that he's got to go through? So if there's a conventional farmer that's decided started, hey, I've got X amount of land and I want to turn 50% of it into certified organic land?
Yeah, so the process differs for different product types and situation. So the first step is to actually be sure that you are going to be able to comply with the relevant standards. Going ahead and applying for certification and then realizing, oh, actually, I can't comply with this, it would be a waste of money. So getting a hold of the relevant standards, so the national standard for organic and biodynamic produce if you're exporting, or the Australian certified organic standard, or the private standard that belongs to the certifier that you choose, and have a read of the relevant sections. They're pretty lengthy documents, so only the relevant sections to your operation. And if you feel that you are going to be able to comply, the next thing to look at developing is your organic management plan. So the organic management plan becomes the key underpinning document for every certification, and it will outline, say for a farmer, how you're going to manage your soil fertility, how you're going to manage your pest and disease in your crops, how you're going to prevent contamination from neighbours or whatever. So putting together your organic management plan, and some people will engage a consultant to help with that. In my experience, the best organic management plans are written by the farmers who know what they're doing. And if they can be encouraged to just write down and explain what they're doing, that's the best way to write an organic management plan. Selecting a certifier is also important. So there are a few to choose from in Australia. Products may end up on export markets, then that's something to consider and ask the different certifiers which export market access they can provide, because that's still a bit of a murky space in terms of international trade. Once you've chosen a certifier and got your organic management plan together, you can apply for certification, and then the certification body has a look at your organic management plan. If they think it's sufficient and compliant, they'll allocate your inspection to one of their auditors. Then you'll be in basically an annual audit cycle, and after a year or so, you can get to what's called certified in conversion. And after 3 years of organic management, you can get to what used to be called A-grade. It's just called certified organic now. Then you will be in an annual surveillance cycle.
So is it possible to have a farm that is 50% certified organic and 50% non-organic?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Part property certification is allowable, especially for conversion. So if you are a commercial operator and you, for instance, vegetables or some other horticulture, and you just want to convert a small part of the farm, see if you can do it, see if the market's there, and then potentially convert more of your farm over time, that is absolutely a great way to go.
Why do you think there are more farmers choosing to turn to certified organic?
Yeah, there are a lot of different reasons from a consumer point of view too, that there seems to be a lot of different reasons that consumers choose to buy organic. And at the production level, at the farm level, there seems to be different reasons for different people. I got into the industry mostly for environmental reasons, because I could see that it was a better way to farm from an environmental viewpoint, not degrading the land, not leaching synthetic nutrients into the waterways, and so on. Ultimately, it's probably mostly a marketing decision for farmers, certainly for commercial farmers, if they want to get on board this industry that's growing so quickly and benefit from that. That could be what's driving their decision to try out organics. Maybe some of their bigger customers are already asking for it. Hey, can we get, you know, some organic vegetables from you as well? In some instances, that will be happening for sure. One reason that I'm really interested in, and I only sort of stumbled across it by accident, is a common theme that farmers, maybe it wasn't their reason for going that way, but one of the things that they're most happy about with their decision for going organic is that they don't have to mix chemicals anymore.
Yeah, this is a very interesting one, because I remember listening to you speak last year at Hawk Connections in Melbourne. Honestly, that was the sentence that I remember the clearest. You got up there and you said, you might be eating conventional vegetables or fruit that are laden with herbicides, pesticides and whatnot, and that's just a small part of your diet, so you're fine. But these farmers are out there every single day mixing these bad chemicals in a way that they're around at 80% of their life. And what does that do to them, and what does it do to their body? And that was very, very interesting for me. And that's kind of something that stuck with me.
Yes, I remember it as well. Yeah. Yes, that was a good conference. That was great fun. So yeah, the workplace health and safety side of it is, it's undeniable. Some of the chemicals that are used in conventional farming are really dangerous to handle. So you have to wear comprehensive safety equipment to do the mixing. And, you know, if you spill it on your lap or something, it can kill you. Some of these chemicals, it's no joke. If you're employing staff to do that work on your farm, or if you have your own family mixing chemicals, it's a concern for most farmers. And, you know, it can probably be done safely, but if you're using all the safety equipment and so on. But that's one thing that a lot of farmers have said to me, is they're so relieved that they just don't have to mix chemicals anymore. and they don't have to have staff mixing chemicals anymore. And I think that may eventually flow through to even to insurance premiums and so on. And another slightly related issue is they're not ever going to get in trouble for creating overspray or for creating contamination on someone else's product, so that they can rest easier with that.
Why do you think that the demand is there for organic produce now?
Well, personally, as I said, I got into the industry and the reason I buy organic produce and have for a long time, from my perspective, is mostly an environmental, or was when I was younger, especially mostly from an environmental point of view. So I wanted to vote for organic farming. Every dollar that you spend at the supermarket or at another retail outlet is a dollar that is a vote for a method of farming. And the abundance and low cost of conventional food is often at a cost that's not included in that purchase of those vegetables or whatever. The environmental cleanup cost will catch up with us at some point. Organic farming has that environmental cleanup cost built in to the cost. And for every dollar you spend, you're voting for better farming methods. So that was certainly my reason for getting involved at the outset. I'm also very thrilled that I'm cutting my pesticide intake. Some people don't believe that this is an issue, but it is a fact. If you're eating organic, you're cutting your pesticide intake. And I guess awareness of this has just grown so much over the last couple of decades that demand is increasing.
I guess that's that old saying that, every dollar that you spend on organic, you're convincing another farmer to grow organic.
Yeah, and the market is well and truly deciding. Like the demand is there.
That leads me to my next question. Your diet is very interesting, and I find this fascinating. You eat predominantly two things, which is organic eggs and organic meat.
Yes, it's true. I'm doing the carnivore diet thing, and that's just sort of for personal health. I seem to just do much better just on steak and eggs. Maybe 7 years or something since I've had any sort of processed food or sugar. I was on, I guess, what you might call like a paleo diet, having lots of vegetables, some fruit and meat, no legumes or grains so much, and that was working quite well. But I still had a few health issues, and then I heard about this carnivore diet thing and initially thought, well, that's ridiculous. But the more I looked into it, I learned that it was quite a safe thing to try. Like, heaps of people have tried going vegetarian, right? Like, I would say maybe most people, yeah, we've all tried it, right? Whether it's for 2 weeks or 2 years, or it's very common to try going vegetarian, even vegan. But then when you say you're going to go the opposite and only eat animal products, people think you're going to die. They think you're crazy and you're going to die, but that's not the case. You can absolutely live, and arguably the reason we've got to the point we are now is due to eating animal products. And if they're certified organic, they're perfectly good for the environment. Like cows are not evil. If you're eating certified organic beef, you're carbon neutral. The methane argument and so on just does not apply based on my research. So you can be comfortable eating an animal product-based diet from an environmental point of view. And after 2 years of only eating animals, I'm still alive, don't have scurvy.
I find that super interesting as well, because with eggs, and this is just a personal preference of mine, but even the difference between organic eggs, free-range eggs, and cage eggs is enormous. Think about just cage eggs and you're cracking the actual eggshell, and how many times it actually takes to crack the eggshell as opposed to an organic or a free-range egg. They're just so much fresher. That blows my mind, for one.
Yeah, well, with eggs particularly, there are some supply chain issues that others would know more about than I. Theoretically, yeah, like often by the time you get an egg, especially from a supermarket, I think it's weeks and weeks old. And perhaps if you're getting organic, they might not have been in transit for so long. And yeah, I mean, the quality, you start to really notice the difference in quality.
And I guess people don't really understand the whole concept of organic beef or organic meat, because you think, obviously, you're not spraying your cows with pesticides. But one of the main parts of an organic animal is the fact that they are free to roam. Is there anything else in the standard around livestock?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think you're right. A lot of people seem to think, oh, well, you know, it's lamb, it's organic anyway, yeah, right? And I'm like, no, or the same for beef. So there are definitely a lot more restrictions on organic production for beef and for lamb and
chickens.
For poultry. It's a lot more than just being free range. And yeah, it's true. You might not be like you would spray a conventional crop with pesticides and fungicides. Yeah, you're not probably spraying your cows with that. However, conventional farmers are using synthetic fertilizers on the pasture, potentially, using herbicide in for spot spraying, using drenches for internal parasites and external parasites, potentially using growth promotants and hormones, antibiotics, sometimes all the time. They're still used as a prophylactic to help weight gain in some instances, which in these days of antibiotic resistance is just scary. But, and yeah, the big one, one, the feedlotting. So animals have to be out on pasture to be certified organic. Conventional meat birds, the growing out time is a matter of weeks. And so in the organic standards, it talks about using genetics, so using breeds of birds that are natural as possible and that are not just bred for super fast growing times. But the genetics that are available for meat bird production in Australia is a bit limited. So even the organic meat birds are growing fairly quickly. But yeah, when you are not using as many of the synthetic growth promotants, it's one of the products that you can really tell the difference between organic and conventional, and free range sitting somewhere in between there is chicken. Chicken meat, organic, tends to be far more enjoyable to eat.
So you're currently the chief technical officer for Australian Organic. What is it that you actually do for AOL? I know that you're our technical guy on a day-to-day or a week-to-week basis. What is it that you do?
Yeah, so I've moved out of actually doing many inspections or auditing for the certification bodies and am now thrilled to be working with Australian Organic, just an industry body, Australia's largest industry body for organic farmers. I bring the 20 years of experience in organic certification with me. Well, so to answer your question, what do I do day to day? Yes, I'm working on the standard, the ACO, the Australian Certified Organic Standard. I'm working on updating, and there'll be a 2020 or 2021 version. I am also working on our non-GMO scheme standard. So AOL owns the BUD scheme. So the BUD logo that you see on produce in the marketplace is certified to the BUD scheme, which AOL owns. So AOL doesn't do the day-to-day certification. That's licensed out to certification bodies. And we used to own a certification body, but that's 2 years ago now that we demerged from ACO. So they still deliver the BUD certification, and at least one other certification body also can offer it now in Australia, and hopefully more to come. So I'm working on that scheme level. So keeping the standard up to date, publishing interpretations of the standard if certifiers or operators have questions about what this means, are we complying? And trying to raise the level of professionalism of the BUD certification scheme in alignment with to sort of industry best practice standards. I end up doing a fair amount of technical writing and liaising with government departments on trying to help our industry maintain and expand export market access, because that's super tricky, especially at the moment, the equivalence arrangements or the recognition arrangements globally. I spend a fair amount of time on that. In Australia to date, we've only technically had export regulation for the use of the word organic. So if you want to export something as organic, you legally have to have it certified, and you have to have a government signed off letter with each shipment. But for the domestic market, there still isn't any legislation about the use of the word organic. So the certifiers in Australia basically just adopted that export standard and started using it domestically. And it's worked really well. It's been a self-regulated domestic certification sector for the last 20 years, and it's worked quite well. However, we're running into problems, especially with negotiating export market access, where that export market government says, what, you don't have domestic regulation? We're not even going to talk to you about negotiating an equivalence deal. So that's one reason we would like it. And also the ongoing problem of produce in the marketplace with an organic claim that might not be certified at all. And there's not really anything to stop them doing that other than waiting for some sort of strong precedent to be set in the courts, which just hasn't happened. So yes, having some domestic regulation around the use of the word organic on produce here in Australia would protect our consumers and have benefits for our industry with export market access as well.
Because there's not really a governance around that domestically, is there?
Well, no. Fortunately, the majors have been on board. The major supermarkets and the major wholesalers over the last couple of decades have been on board and have basically said, yeah, we want certification. Go talk to ACO or go talk to NASA and get your certification, and then we'll buy from you. Mm. And that's how it's worked. But some other operator may still just whack the word organic on the product and sell it out of another outlet and have sort of an unfair advantage over the certified operator in that way.
You're also a part of the National Standards Subcommittee. What is it that you do for them?
So my position on the National Standards Subcommittee is just in my own personal capacity. AOL don't formally have a seat on that board at all, but in my personal capacity, helping update the national standard. So there is a group which is authorised by the government to look after the national standard, which is the export standard, the National Standard for Organic and Biodynamic Produce. They're called OISC, Organic Industry Standards and Certification Council, and they have a subcommittee called the National Standards Subcommittee, specifically tasked with upkeeping the national standard. So anybody can send a request for a change to the national standard, and the National Standard Subcommittee will look at that. And following a framework, we'll consider whether that will be allowable or not. So it could be we want to use this ingredient, or it could be clarify this type of production method. Is this allowed or not? So I get to put my heads together with some other really experienced people from the organic industry in Australia and try to reword or adjust.
Play God.
In our little world.
Decide yes or no.
Well, we have a really good framework to work within.
Right.
And we always use the Codex Organic Standard as the basis. It's the Codex Alimentarius Organic Standard, which sits under the Food and Agricultural Organization of the World Health Organization. That is the global sort of guidance standard at top level. We also will use the IFOM standard, International Federation of Organic Agriculture Movements, and we'll use EU. The EU regulation is another world leader, and we want to ensure market access for Australian operators. So we usually kind of have to work within those standards anyway. So it can't easily be corrupted, changed too much. What we can do is try to make practical interpretations for Australian operators.
So how does organic farming differ from regenerative agriculture?
One of my favourite topics. So going back a little bit before I'd heard of regenerative, so when I was at uni, so as we said, not that long ago, 20 years or so, there was a lot of use of the word sustainable. So sustainable agriculture, that was the buzzword. This might be before your time, Kelsey. But sustainable agriculture was what everybody was talking about, a lot of our lecturers, and there was sort of funding going into that. I saw that word just lose meaning almost entirely. People talk about sustainability, but in my opinion, really lost its meaning. To demonstrate that it doesn't really mean what it originally should have meant, people often say, oh, it's more sustainable. So, okay, if something's more sustainable, it's just it either is or it isn't, isn't it? It's like your sustainable should be a yes or a no. So more sustainable is like, so what does it even mean? So I think that's why the word regenerative was coined and is getting a lot more interest now. Regenerative agriculture, I'm hearing about regenerative medicine and regenerative health now as well in other circles. But for now, let's stick to the regenerative ag, regen ag maybe for short. It seems to me it has a lot of similarities to organic farming. Sometimes it includes other farming systems like biodynamic farming systems or natural sequence farming or even key line. Like some of these great Australian developments actually seem to be lumped into that category of regenerative agriculture. Different people give different definitions, but it's so similar to organics. It's along the lines of we want to produce good quality food and leave the land in a better condition than it was when we arrived, and yada, yada, yada. The problem that I have is that there's not a clear definition, and that when all of the definitions I hear for regenerative are already covered off by organics. So organic farming is regenerative agriculture, but I am aware of other people who self-identify and report to be regenerative farmers who do use herbicides and synthetic nitrates and stuff like that organic farmers are not allowed to use. So, and maybe that's fine in certain instances, but it's just hard to know what the definition is. In America, it's a bit different. I think the regenerative agriculture movement in America is an important one because the US organic standard arguably has a couple of weaknesses. Some people believe that it's not strong enough on animal welfare, for instance. So in the United States, there's now a regenerative agriculture certification, and it relies on being certified organic, according to the US Department of Ag, plus some additional things. And those additional things include improved animal welfare. Oh, one of the other additional things is around workplace health and safety. But in Australia, the organic standard is already very strict on animal welfare, and Australian federal law is very strict on workplace health and safety. So we don't really have a need for an additional regenerative agriculture certification here. It's just covered by organics. Organic farming is regenerative agriculture, so maybe not the other way around.
Earlier on, you mentioned the wording precautionary principle. What is precautionary principle and how does it apply to the organic standard?
Yeah, so the precautionary principle is, I'm probably going to butcher this definition a little bit, but in my words, in my terms, that the principle that we maybe shouldn't adopt new technologies if we're not 100% absolutely without a doubt sure that it's going to be safe and that the potential second order effects aren't going to be damaging either, and if we don't really need to. So the precautionary principle underlies all organic standards development and guides organic standards development and always has. There are plenty of examples in history, and that doesn't mean organic farmers are against technology, not at all. We need technology to continue. We need farmers to continue to innovate, and that's how our standard of living improves over time. That's economic. tracks. But there have been many examples over the time where technological breakthroughs have ended up being probably a pretty bad idea. And an example that comes to mind is like lead in petrol. It made cars run a lot better, but it, you know, it ended up polluting the globe.
Environmentally not so good, yeah.
Well, and human health. Like they've associated lead in petrol with global declines in IQ of that generation. And that's now improving since the 80s, since it was phased out. Obviously, that is arguable, but it's pretty convincing. The lead content of people living near highways and so on was getting to the point where it could have been affecting people's brains. So was that predictable? Could it have been prevented? I don't know. But a little dose of the precautionary principle may have gone a long way there, because now, of course, we are able to use cars and without lead and they drive fine. That's just one example. There are many others, especially in agriculture, especially in industrial chemicals. I think like some people still claim that DDT has saved more lives than it's damaged due to reducing malaria, for instance. But all that data is very hard to work out what's true there. But what is true is that DDT has now been phased out because it is that dangerous. Maybe a dose of precautionary principle, because we don't need it. That's the thing. Like, and GMOs come into this category for organic farmers as well. The reason that GMOs are excluded is it's just the precautionary principle. When you're tinkering with the very building blocks of biology, and when it's a technology that you can't bring back in, like once it's out there, once it's in the environment, once genetic material's out in the environment, you can't just say, oh, well, we've got to stop using that now, bring it all back in. You know, if airplanes turned out being a bad idea, we can pull them all out of the sky and not use them again. But with GMOs, once they're out there in the field, they're out there. So precautionary principle led to the decision to just exclude them from organic farming, because we don't need it. We're farming fine without it. We have genetic material that's appropriate for producing food in all areas of the globe already.
So for any producers or farmers or businesses who perhaps say it's too expensive or it isn't worth the trouble to become certified organic, what would you say to that?
In some instances, that's probably correct. And paying for certification, I mean, I'd encourage all farmers to farm organically because it's best practice farming, and I think they'll be happier farming organically. But whether to get certified should just be a business decision. If it is too expensive, or if it doesn't provide them with an additional market size or additional market premium, then maybe certification is not for them. It does require some time, and it usually requires some additional record keeping, and certification can cost, usually for a farm, it's somewhere in the order of like $1,000 or $2,000 a year, to speak very broadly. So yeah, it's not hugely expensive, but it is an amount of money, $1,000 or $2,000 a year. Of the Bud Organic scheme, we also ask for and greatly appreciate a licensing fee, which is a small percentage of those sales. So yeah, there's costs involved. If it gives you the marketing edge and it improves your profitability, then you should go ahead with it. If you just want to be certified because it feels nice, well, you might not end up being so comfortable with the expenditure year after year if it's not making you earn more money, yeah.
What are the requirements for a cosmetic product to be certified organic?
So for cosmetic products, all of the agricultural origin ingredients are required to be certified organic. And then there's quite a strict list of other additives and ingredients that are allowable, which is more lenient than the food list. So there's some, what they sometimes call sort of green chemistry, simple chemical products that, as an example, like sodium hydroxide for making soap. So for saponification of an oil, use some hydroxide. Obviously, sodium or potassium hydroxide is not allowed in an organic food product, but it is allowed for the purpose of making an organic soap. So yeah, for this soap example, all of the oil would need to be certified organic, and the hydroxide just needs to be normal and not contaminated. All of the other rules still apply, like non-GMO, like no irradiation and no nanotechnology. That's relevant for cosmetics. Organic prohibits nanotechnology, again, due to precautionary principle. Those particles are really small and they do go right into your blood when you put them on your skin. So that's enough of an alarm bell for organic standard setters to just leave it out. We don't need them.
So there are some products that are not able to be certified. Can you run me through those?
Yeah, sure. So organic certification is applicable only to agricultural produce. So while you may have seen over the years things like organic water or organic salt, you shouldn't really see that anymore, and they probably always didn't quite belong, because organic certification is for agricultural produce. So for any mineral product like a salt, that can't technically be certified organic. And for water, I mean, there's one example where water could be certified organic, and that's if you extract extracted it all from a fruit, like watermelon juice, and you filtered it so well that it was straight water. But yeah, so water out of the ground or rainwater or anything like that, that falls outside the scope of organic certification as well. Same with farm inputs. So there's sometimes a bit of confusion about that. Like you might say that's some certified organic compost. It's usually not certified organic in its own right because it's not an agricultural product. It's a farm input. So farm inputs can't be certified organic. They can be certified as allowed inputs. So there's a specific category set aside for those types of inputs.
So you've seen changes in the industry over the last 15 to 20 years. You've obviously been a part of a lot of them, but what do you suggest that we as an industry need to do to have a collaborative approach to domestic regulation in Australia?
So there's a lot of work going on in the background already here at AOL. There will be a lot of engagement coming up in terms of how to build a domestic regulation program that will work for industry and for consumers and for all stakeholders. So I think at this stage, it's just sort of watch this space. It will be important that all sectors are represented so that we don't miss anything.
Thanks so much for your time today, Owen. It's been really great chatting to you.
Thanks for having me, Kelsey.
Thanks for listening to the Australian Organic Collective podcast. If you have a minute, I'd love if you could rate and review this podcast wherever you're listening to it. If you'd like to get in touch with Owen, you can track him down on Twitter at Owen Gwilliam. This podcast is all thanks to our podcast sponsor, Cleavers Organic. If you're feeding the family or you're feeding the team, you know that you can trust Cleavers for 100% delicious certified organic meat. Plus, every Cleavers product is carbon neutral. Find yours in the fresh meat section at your supermarket. We'll be chatting to the team from Cleavers on the next episode of the Australian Organic Collective. And if you'd like to be involved in a future episode, get in touch with us either via one of our social media platforms or email contact@ostorganic.com. And as we, Australian Organic, push for domestic regulation in 2020, I just want to remind you, no logo means it's a no-go.